ESPN College Football Podcast.
Indeed, it is the ESPN College Football Podcast for Wednesday, August 3rd, 2022. And we are live with each other in person in Bristol, Connecticut. I'm Adam Rittenberg with my friends and colleagues, Heather Dinich, Bill Connolly, Tom Van Herren. I'm looking at you guys, not just hearing you guys on or seeing you guys on Zoom, but we're all together getting ready for the college football season with the meetings and get-togethers and fun stuff at night. So hello to you all.
Hello, and this means college football has to be right around the corner, because when we're together talking about it, that's when I feel like it starts to get real.
We have no excuse that we're muted, that we're frozen. We're here live in front of each other. It's beautiful. You look a lot clearer in person.
Well, I do blur out the back of my Zoom deal, so that's I don't want you guys to see everything in my home office. But
The most fun part, though.
Yeah.
But I won't try to mute you guys while we're doing this.
you can certainly try. You wouldn't be the first. But it is great to see everyone. And as you mentioned, Heather, we're closer to the college football season. We're in the month of August, which means actual college football games will kick off. Week zero coming up the last weekend of the month. We got Northwestern and Nebraska and Ireland and a bunch of other week zero games. And then we get into the meat of the season, Labor Day weekend. So it's getting closer. Camps are opening around the country. If they haven't already, pretty much every team has reported at this point. So practices are going on, and we will have plenty of time to make predictions, very early, low stakes predictions about the college football season. But before that, some of the, I wouldn't call it boring because it's not boring. It's spicy, quite, you know, honestly, with what went on at the Pac-12 media day, but we're still in this realignment afterglow of what happened with the Big Ten adding USC and UCLA. Last podcast, Andre Adelson and I talked about what we could expect at Pac-12 media day. And what we got, Heather, was a very fired up George Kliavkov, their commissioner, who we really hadn't heard from publicly in any sort of extensive comments since the Big Ten raid on his conference, adding UCLA and USC for the 2024 season. But instead of unloading on the Big Ten or even on those individual schools, he directed his at least most public vitriol towards the Big 12, which made a very aggressive push almost right away for additional Pac-12 schools, looking at that conference as vulnerable. The Big 12 presidents, their board and their ADs have directed their new commissioner, Brent Yormark, everyone in that league towards how do we get bigger if it makes sense. And George Kliavkov obviously did not take well to the Big 12's aggressiveness and continued aggressiveness to try to further weaken the Pac-12.
He specifically said he was going to take the high road regarding USC and UCLA leaving, and then proceeded to turn around and say, well, I'm glad the Big 12 is open for business. We might go shopping there. We haven't decided if we're going shopping there yet. So the reason, and I think it was hard for college football fans to understand, is because behind the scenes, the Big 12, and publicly too, was talking to reporters in the media about how we want to be aggressive. We want to play offense. We absolutely want to go after some Pac-12 teams, make ourselves strong. And saying things like, we're in a better position than we were a year ago. Now we're the conference in a position of strength. And I think that while Kliavkov got up in front of the media, he said what he had to say in terms of being bullish about the future and just portraying strength and unity. He kind of lost it a little bit because the frustrations have boiled over. And we saw this exact same thing happen with Bob Bowlsby in the Big 12 when OU and Texas decided to leave. I mean, these guys got dinged, and it's just human nature for that to come out at some point.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, yeah, obviously he should be madder at the Big 10 and UCLA and USC and everything. But this was kind of both of these conferences are just trying to send messages. We're fine. We're fine. We're actually in great shape right now. And that's a very natural part of this process. I mean, in the end, I would say that the best result here for college football is if both of these conferences really are in great shape and stable moving forward. And the Pac-10, now Pac-10, adds a couple more teams and we move forward as is. But it'll be really interesting to see what the numbers are, you know, all these evaluations going on. It'll be interesting to see if one has a valuation a lot bigger than the other. And that'll pretty much drive what happens next.
I think a lot of the frustration too, Adam, you and I were at Big Ten Media Days together and we got a chance to talk to some of the coaches. And I said to a coach, I think a lot of this expansion right now is not really about necessarily saying we want to expand. It's about protecting your conference. Mm-hmm. And the Big Ten protected themselves by adding two premier teams to where no matter what happens, they look favorable. They look like if other teams are looking to join a conference, the Big Ten is attractive to other teams. Now, where the Pac-12 lost those teams, the Big 12 is actively saying maybe we want to go poach them. And so he's in a not favorable position as a commissioner, knowing that these teams are getting poached. He's not able to protect his conference, and that's a big problem with the state of everything.
Yeah, I don't think there's a humongous difference between these two conferences overall, but I do think it probably benefits the Big 12 a hair to have gone through this already. And if nothing else, having snatched Houston and BYU out right. of the group, not to say the Pac-12 would have invited either one of those for sure, but they would have been options. And now it would be a lot harder to pry them away. So that certainly helped the Big 12. I just don't know if it helps so much more that, you know, eventually Utah and whatnot are going to want to come over.
If he does have angst, though, towards anyone on the UCLA, USC, Big Ten side, to me, it should not be the Big Ten, because the Big Ten didn't poach those schools. USC and UCLA said, hey, can we please join you? We need some help. And I don't know that he or anyone necessarily is really mad at those schools the way the Big 12 was mad at OU in Texas, because there's an acknowledgement right now that if you can go make $80 to $100 million per year, what are you going to do?
Right.
You're going to go take the money, right? And so there's sort of a concession. Everybody's kind of doing what they have to do. So I just think it's a little bit different in terms of the anger. But the deception's all the same.
Well, I think what's fascinating, too, is the history between these two conferences and realignment. We all remember what Larry Scott, the former Pac-12 commissioner, Georgia's predecessor, tried to do, which was essentially destroy the Big 12 by adding Texas and Oklahoma and Texas Tech and Oklahoma State and become the Pac-16. And that didn't happen. And then last year, the Pac-12 made another serious, at least, exploration of adding Big 12 schools when that league was weakened following the departures of Texas and Oklahoma. I had a source at a existing Big 12 school, not one that's being brought in through the expansion, tell me, hey, we were 5 minutes away from joining the Pac-12, and then something happened. And so I think there is some anger towards UCLA and maybe USC even more so, because USC, I think, was one of those schools that maybe put the kibosh on not adding from the Big 12 last year and acting, hey, we should go forward together. We're united. We're the Pac-12. And then they were clearly motivated by the money and the financial stability to leave for the Big 10. I mean, UCLA's situation is more complicated because of the state and because of the UC system, but it's not complicated, as you guys know, from a financial standpoint, because that department, even though they did reach a settlement with Under Armour for about $68 million this week with that whole apparel dispute, they are still very much in the red as an athletic department, and they'll get closer to getting out of that when they join the Big Ten.
But one thing that George Kliavkov can do and has to do right now is negotiate a TV deal and find some way to close the revenue gap enough to impress Washington, right, Oregon, Cal, Stanford, and say, hey, we've got this. We're going to be okay. We're not going to be first or second. Nobody is. It's the SEC and the Big Ten. But we're going to have a respectable conference here. Here's why you should stay. That is a tall task for him right now, but yeah, it's his number one job.
Yeah, and I think it's also going to be about the grant of rights, how long they would, because like we just admitted, if Oregon and Washington get invited to the Big Ten, they're going to go to the Big Ten no matter what. But how long are you going to make them tie themselves to the new Pac-12? After we find out the valuation and everything else, that's kind of the next step, and I really don't know how to expect that to go.
But also, long term, does any of this matter? Because where is everything headed? I mean, we were at Big Ten Media Days. You guys were out at Media Days. I don't know if you heard this, but we've heard, at least I have, from coaches more in the past 6 months than I ever have about super conferences and about potentially breaking off from the NCAA and doing their own thing, taking the college football playoff with them. So short term, this could have some big impacts, but long term, what is everything going to look like? I don't know that anybody really knows.
No, they don't. And I think the it's important for fans to realize that could certainly be the end game, that there is this breakaway, but in the immediate, it's important to understand the media rights game. You touched on it, Bill. There is no way on both sides that the Pac-12 is going to lock itself into a long-term media agreement with the rights signed away, because you saw what happens with the ACC and their position right now. You know, even though they're not on the verge of collapsing, they might be if their rights are in a different situation. But I think the new model for everybody going forward are going to be these shorter term deals like the Big Ten did. It's why they're going back to market for everybody else. And I don't think the Pac-12 was ever going to do a long-term media deal the next time around, but they are at the end of this exclusive negotiating window with Fox and with ESPN. And then George Kliavkov is going to go out and see who else is interested, and whether it's Amazon or Apple or other media partners that they haven't been contracted with. And then he's going to have to report back to Washington and Oregon, and then he'll have an answer, at least as far as how long they want to remain in the league.
And it's funny, this is actually becoming like recruiting, kind of, where you're just basically going to take the best offer you have. You're not going to commit for an entire, 5 years of eligibility or whatever. If you get an offer from Alabama, you're going to go to Alabama. And if you don't, you'll go to, insert school here, Oregon State or whatever. So it's the whole idea of long-term conference membership is kind of out the window now if you're not the SEC and Big Ten. And we'll see what that means for these two conferences in particular.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting month. I'm curious what you guys think will be the reaction to the Big Ten's media agreement, which I think will be announced by August 15th, but I was just told last night might be August 20th. And Heather and I were told by Kevin Warren back in May that it would be Memorial Day. So this thing is continuing to be pushed back. But I think it's safe to say that in the fairly near future, we'll know the numbers for the Big Ten's media deal. What's the reaction then from Notre Dame? What's the reaction from those Pac-12 schools that might be on the Big Ten's radar, but may not be?
Well, I think the bottom line is what everyone wants to know. And you brought up Notre Dame, which is the X factor in all of this. And I quite honestly haven't heard anything from anyone that gives any indication that Notre Dame is ready to just ditch history and tradition and go join a league. And it's important for people to remember that contractually, if they were to join a conference, it has to start with the ACC, unless they were to withdraw their other sports and they can go play football wherever they want. But they are, and I've used this analogy before, they're the blue square on Monopoly. Everybody knows the value, everybody wants the property, and they're just sitting there and they're looking good. And if they get more money from their own TV deal, they might not have to go anywhere. And I think maybe if Stanford were to join, and you have these rivals that are built into the Big Ten, and Notre Dame athletic director Jack Swarbrick gets a bottom line that just, completely blows up what they could do and their value, then yes, that's when you get a serious consideration. But don't forget, they would have to withdraw from the ACC, pay the exit fee. Not that they couldn't do that, but there's a significant financial penalty for coming out of the ACC in order to join the Big Ten. So you have to weigh all of that. And they certainly would do that. But as we sit here this skinny minute, I would be surprised, quite frankly, if Notre Dame joined a conference.
Yeah, they're the one school that we know would add. We talk about value, and obviously there are a bunch of good programs out there. You can add Oregon and Washington. You can add, when ACC schools become available as we get closer to the end of the grant of rights, there are plenty of good programs there. The only one we know would increase that per school value for the Big Ten, without a doubt, would be Notre Dame. And you kind of almost have to entice, if they're going to bring in Stanford or Cal or whatever, it would be to entice Notre Dame, I think, because they would bring that number down. And so that's kind of the one thing, is we don't know if Oregon and Washington would increase that value. We don't know which ACC schools might. We know Notre Dame would.
Right. And again, I think it's important to remember, to your point, Heather, they will get more money from their next television agreement. I still think the primary motivator, though, for Notre Dame ultimately won't be money. It will be scheduling and playoff access. And if they can keep those at the level that they're at right now, which they're happy with, they've been part of the playoff at 4. They presumably would be part of it at 8 or 12 or 16. I think they'll probably end up staying put. But that's enough realignment. I want to talk about the season, and I want to talk about predictions. And nobody can hold these two, hold us to them completely, because it's August 3rd. A lot of things are going to happen from now until kickoff later this month or in September. But Bill, you preview the season like none other. So we're going to start with you. What are some predictions, early predictions that you're willing to offer. Let's just say by the end of September, what are some of the things we're going to know around college football?
Well, it's funny. I've been pretty big on trying to remind everybody that USC also has to play defense, and therefore this talk of a nice national title run or whatever.
Defense? What's defense?
It's going to be kind of an issue for them. But even if we accept that they're really not a contender, they could pretty easily start 6-0 this year. So the hype train, wherever it is at now, it could get a lot louder before, you know, then at the end they have to go at Utah, at UCLA, Notre Dame at home. Everything gets a lot harder. But at Stanford, that's not, you know, obviously they've struggled with Stanford before, but that's a certainly very winnable game. Fresno State, Arizona State at home, Washington State at home, at Oregon State, all these road trips are going to be even more hostile than normal because of the realignment episode. But those are extremely winnable games. And if they are improved to just kind of a top 20 level, they'll probably be 6-0. It'll get pretty loud.
I just want you guys to know that I've been asking our editor to go to USC Utah since like March. Oh. So we can arm wrestle now if you want, but it's already on the table.
I think someone else might already have that game already, and not in this room, but no, it should be one of the fun ones going into week one. I'm actually, my prediction, my first one at least, is about the team that Lincoln Riley left, Oklahoma. Yep. And it's funny, Bill, because they're in similar positions where I think the new coach inherits a really good offense and has a defense that he has to improve. And it's why I'm more bullish on Brent Venables, like long term, maybe even more so than Lincoln Riley, because Lincoln Riley showed what Oklahoma was. It was this great offense, Heisman Trophy winning quarterbacks. They were never good enough defensively to win the national championship. And I think Brent Venables is the type of coach, even with the SEC transition coming up, that can make them good enough defensively to be more competitive when they get to the playoff phase, which might even be this season. I mean, I look at their schedule, yeah. Certainly some potentially tricky games. Kent State can score. Nebraska, who knows? It's on the road. They may be 3-0 going into that game. But then Kansas State at home at TCU, first-year coach with Sonny Dykes. I think Oklahoma goes into the Red River game undefeated and being talked about as a college football playoff contender, you know, 1 year removed from obviously, you know, playing its way out of that race. I think I'm more bullish on this Sooners team when I look at, you know, Dylan Gabriel, if he can stay healthy, the offensive firepower left over, and a coach who, quite frankly, will have a better plan defensively than they've had.
I just want to skip ahead to the college football playoff and the national championship. Oh. And I'm going just immediately to the championship game, and I'm going to put this out there. And you said in the beginning, you can't hold us to this. People will absolutely hold us to this. I'm going to be on my couch watching Ohio State play Texas A&M in the national championship.
Wow. Okay.
We're going to be watching that game. I just feel it. The way that Texas A&M has recruited, some of the guys that they're adding, even in this last class, defensively, especially up front, they've got some big names, some guys that are going to contribute early. They have a little bit more stability at quarterback as long as Haynes King can stay healthy. They've got Max Johnson now, who's a stable addition at the position. I just feel like everything that's happened this offseason, Jimbo and Nick Saban going after each other, I feel like Jimbo is pretty fired up.
I think you spent a lot of time around our guy Dave Wilson here the last 24 hours. I think this is the Dave Wilson effect on Tom Van Aaron.
There is no Dave Wilson cash in my pocket, I promise. But and then you look at the opposite side, the Ohio State. I think we've all probably talked about Ohio State, that how do they screw it up and not get there is a bigger question of will they get there? I think everybody thinks with what they have at quarterback, with CJ Stroud, new defensive staff coming in, they've added some additions there. Seems like from talking to Ryan Day, there's a little bit more stability. There's some talking to him at Big Ten Media Days. There was some optimism in the first couple practices that they've had, even from the players. We heard going back and forth with CJ Stroud saying the offense and the defense, it went back and forth. They would win, then we would win, then they would win. I just feel like the Buckeyes, there's a bigger chance of them getting there than there is not.
And Heather, you wrote a great piece recently about Jim Knowles, the new defensive coordinator at Ohio State, who I think is clearly the most important assistant coaching addition of the offseason, and his impact coming from Oklahoma State, where he not only improved the defense, but improved the way that they went about winning games. Just that was the impact he had on that Mike Gundy-led program. Now going to Ohio State, what do you think will happen? happen with this Buckeye team? Is it going to be a pretty easy run for them getting back to the Big Ten championship game? Could there be some, you know, some turbulence along the way? What are we to expect from Ohio State?
It's not going to be easy, not when you open with Notre Dame. I mean, Marcus Freeman played at Ohio State. That's a huge game, and I can't wait to see it. But I think that what they have with what Tom mentioned offensively is the best coming back in the country production-wise, a year after being the best, with a quarterback who's probably a first-round draft pick, right? But, I mean, I just got to say, forget the Aggies. I'm going with Saban and Alabama. But yes, Ohio State. But back to Ohio State, Jim Knowles, I think, is the missing piece to the puzzle. I don't necessarily think that the defense is going to be number one in the country, but it's going to be improved enough that this team can go back to the national title and possibly, conceivably win it.
Yeah, and that's the thing he has going for him more than anything is he doesn't have to have the number one defense in the country. Right. He just has to improve them a little bit because they really weren't far off the pace last year, even though Michigan and Oregon pushed them around so much. It's not like those games weren't still winnable pretty late into the second half, at least. So they have by far the most proven offense in the country. It did take Knowles a while at both Duke and Oklahoma State to kind of get everything how he wanted it. And as strange as this sounds, he's not going to have defensive ends as good at Ohio State as he had at Oklahoma State last year. They just had a crazy good collection of defensive ends. But yeah, he just has to get them to like a kind of a top 20 or 30 level. And it's kind of, they should always have a top 20 or 30 defense.
Well, one of the things that he told me that stuck in my head that I really thought was a neat perspective was I asked him, how much film did you watch from last year? And he was like, basically none at all. And I was like, what do you mean? Why? And he said, because I don't want to have any preconceived notions. I want to go in, I want to watch these guys, learn what they can do. And take it from there. And I get it. Like, if we're writing a story that we know somebody else in the country has already written, I will never read it because yeah. I don't want to have it in my head. I want to do my own work, do my own thing, right? And it's kind of like a similar thing. And I think the players have really bought into that and appreciated just the way that he's done it.
Well, and Bill, you're stats driven. Mm-hmm. Outside of that Michigan game, I think if people go back and look, the first couple of games is where the first part of the season, that's where the problem was. The defense got better and it wasn't terrible outside of that Michigan game. I think that factors in too, that our perception of what happened versus reality of what really happened.
Yeah. There are two ways to look at this. You know, the first two games were bad. Minnesota got a good amount of leverage on the ground too. And then the last two games were bad, Michigan and Utah. In the middle, they looked every bit like they're supposed to look at all times, but those were probably the four most physical teams on their schedule, Minnesota, Oregon, Michigan, Utah. And it just kind of happened to be on the schedule where it was. That's the one question that they have to answer this year is when there's somebody with a good physical ground game, can they push back? They don't really have an excuse not to, but they sure didn't last year. All of those teams rush for at least 200 yards on them.
And I think that's probably the biggest question for me going in is up front for them defensively along the defensive line, the guys that they lost. But I think some of the guys that they've added that we haven't seen a ton out of yet. We saw JT Tuimoloau a little bit last year. What he
I just call
flash.
Him JTT.
JTT. Okay, I like that.
But a little home improvement. I appreciate the pronunciation.
Yeah, but younger guys that they have that we haven't seen maybe fully break out yet. If those guys can step up and add what they need to, then they'll be fine. But that's really where I want to see.
Does that mean Javonte Jean Baptiste is JJB?
Oh yeah, I like that. I haven't heard that as much. I'll have to share that with the Ohio State media.
What's fascinating to me about this whole conversation that we're having though is we're all assuming that Harbaugh loses that game. I mean, the dude's just coming off the best, like his best season, and can he build and can he win that game? And we're all like, no, it's Ohio State all the way.
Well, what you mentioned in the beginning, the offense, that I think that's the biggest thing for me is what Michigan's losing on defense. How do you replace Aiden Hutchinson, David Ojabo, Josh Ross, Daxton Hill? That defense has a lot of question marks right now. And we're talking about defensive linemen, Michigan has not recruited, especially in the middle, the defensive tackle spot. They have not recruited that spot very well. And this might be the year where that bites them a little bit. And I don't know how you replace those guys. Aiden Hutchinson, especially last year's Big Ten Media Days, the presence that he had in the locker room, the leadership off the field that he provided even – How do you replace that? I don't know yet. We have to see it.
Well, I feel like with Michigan and Notre Dame, two programs that could take it to the next step if they could find a Heisman caliber quarterback.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. And I want to get into player predictions here. And let's start with Michigan. And I'll go right to you, Tom, because Cade McNamara came to Big Ten Media Days. You don't do that unless you're the starting quarterback at the University of Michigan. However, I think that, and I'm not going to predict it necessarily, but I think we're going to see a lot of J.J. McCarthy this season and potentially him end the season as the starter for the Wolverines. It's going to be fascinating because they open with their very soft opening. Yeah. Will not be challenged, I think, at all until maybe the Big Ten opener against Maryland, certainly the Big Ten road opener at Iowa on October 1st. So I think J.J. is going to get opportunities, if healthy, to play significantly because those first few games shouldn't be overly competitive. And at what point does Michigan think strongly about making a switch? Because as good as Cade McNamara has been, with their losses on defense, for Michigan to win the Big Ten, they're going to need a different level of playmaker at quarterback to exploit the receivers and everything else they have going for them on offense. And I just don't know if Cade's that guy.
Yeah, that part especially for me is what we just talked about with the defense. That last year, you could rely on that defense to stop people, stop Ohio State and beat them in that game. But Cade had 15 touchdowns, 6 interceptions, 2,500 yards. And you're right. You know, going into this, he's probably the starter right now. JJ's a little banged up. He's healing. As far as I know from someone that I spoke to, he should be ready to go by the season, by the time the season starts. And the soft opening helps JJ for sure. I agree with you. The talent level and the ability for JJ McCarthy, it's something that you can't keep him off the field. I think that's how you put it. And someone asked me this, who do I think starts? It's a weird question because Jim Harbaugh is a little bit of a weird guy.
Is he really? Right? Is a weird guy? I didn't know that. Okay.
Where I think he gets attached to his quarterbacks, and the guys that are similar to him, he likes those guys. And I think Cade is probably similar to him in their mindsets, that they are confident in who they are and they like to puff their chest out and show you what they can do with a little bit of a chip on their shoulders. So yeah, I think Cade probably starts out, but I just from covering JJ's recruitment, knowing who he is, knowing this personality that he has and the talent that he has and what he can provide that offense with now a new offensive coordinator in Matt Weiss, I have to imagine, like you said, the end of the year, JJ is probably the starter.
It is kind of a safety versus explosiveness kind of battle here. McNamara is less likely to make a mistake, but you can do a lot more design runs with McCarthy. He's going to look downfield more. He's going to try to take some shots. I guess maybe one other thing to think about here is that the rest of the offense is loaded compared to last year. Even, you know, you still got Corum and you've got Edwards at running back. You've got last year's three best receivers and then the best receiver from the year before. So if you feel you've got the weapons and you just need a safe decision maker, that might keep McNamara on the field a little bit longer.
And Donovan Edwards, you can put him in the pass game as well.
Yeah, that's true.
One thing they do lack is the Haskins type power back, and that's such a so integral to their identity on offense. Are they able to pivot more to a finesse offense, downfield passing? Ronnie Bell, who you mentioned, Bill, is returning from a major knee injury early last year. Can they get away from the power that essentially overpowered Ohio State, Tom, in that game and allowed them to finally end the streak?
What's going to help them is what they return along the offensive line. I mean, the Joe Moore award-winning offensive line basically only losing one player from the starting lineup, and they're replacing their center with a guy who was, I think, a runner-up or a finalist for the Remington Award of the top center in Olu Oluwatimi from Virginia.
Look at Tom
Virginia.
With the pronunciations. I'm so impressed.
It just rolls off the tongue.
It's incredible.
And then you've got Ryan Hayes at left tackle. You've got some veteran guys there up front that I think mitigates some of the loss of Haskins because of what Bill said with Donovan Edwards and Blake Corum. The versatility that you have now with some of those players, I think you can work around that.
A random stat that I enjoy, I don't think it probably means anything because of the small samples, but I enjoy it. Yards after contact per rush. Hassan Haskins was 2.7, Blake Corum was 2.8, and Donovan Edwards was 3.7.
Yeah.
So Edwards especially, he might have a chance to fill that role, but he's definitely a smaller guy.
So I am very curious to get out of the Big Ten and get your thoughts on Clemson, because Dabo Sweeney totally bet on himself with these internal hires. And you've got two coordinators who have never called plays. I mean, one was never even an assistant. Their new defensive coordinator, he was Brent Venables' right-hand man. And then talk about pronunciations and quarterbacks, DJ Uiagalelei. I think I got that right.
Uiagalelei.
Just
break it down like that. It's easy.
You know what? The funny thing is I broke it down and I put it on a yellow post-it note heading into last season. And I think I said his name for the opener. And then I didn't say it anymore. I'm like, well, I'm glad I learned that for Clemson.
From then on, it's just DJ.
Yeah.
You say it once and it's DJ.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, I look at the ACC and I don't know who's going to win it. And I think NC State, Dave Doran might have the best team he's ever had ever, period. End of story. But Clemson's their team. That's their brand name. Can they get back to the playoff?
Yeah, they still know how to win there. And I think Wes Goodwin, who you mentioned, who is Brent's right-hand man, who doesn't have a ton of, I guess, traditional coaching experience in the way that we look at it, inherits one of the most talented groups in the country, yeah, especially up front. Not to say his job is easy, but it's easier on that side of the ball versus, you know, getting DJ right. And that's to me their whole season, because if they're better at quarterback, if they have a little bit more luck on the injury front, on offense overall, I like that they have a new offensive line coach who's familiar with that program. That line, coaches have told me over the years, has been their weak point. And then can they get back to being wide receiver U? Because they've fallen off a little bit there, but we know they have the talent.
Yeah, I had a coach text me something after he promoted Brandon Streeter to offensive coordinator, and it's kind of haunted me all offseason. He's like, 10 years ago, Dabo would have hired Zach Kittley. And imagining Zach Kittley fixing this offense and with that defense, that would put me at a lot more ease heading into the season. Obviously, Kittley's still young. He hasn't proven, you know, a decade's worth of production. But instead of going with the up and the kind of the modernization of attempt here, and instead of trying to innovate, yeah, he's betting on himself and his culture. And I don't know. It's hard to say he's wrong in doing that. But I think, especially as it pertains to the offense, I would have felt a lot better if he'd maybe gone outside that culture a little.
So Clemson predictions, they end the month of September and open October with a really key stretch. The first three games, Georgia Tech, Furman, Louisiana Tech, should be fairly straightforward for them. But then they go to Wake Forest, mm-hmm, the team that won the ACC Atlantic last year. And then the following week, the game that you mentioned, or the team that you mentioned, Heather, NC State, comes into their Death Valley to take on the Tigers. I think that's the defining stretch. What do we predict out of Clemson? Where are they at that point after that NC State game?
Jeez, I don't know. I mean, they have to win it, because they might lose to South Carolina
and Notre Dame.
That's right. But those are both division games. I mean, if they lose those two games, forget about it. I even though the ACC can be weird, that to me is not the season, but it's the early stretch. It gives them a chance to reclaim their dominance. And you know, that defense is going to be tested by Wake Forest and Sam Hartman and everything that they do with that weird offense that Bill loves and I sometimes love, and sometimes it annoys me. And then the next week, Devin Leary, who again is one of these quarterbacks, and I want to get into the prediction game for the quarterbacks, because there's so many that are in this Heisman race going down the odds. Obviously, CJ Stroud, Bryce Young, the defending Heisman Trophy winner from Alabama, they're at the very top. Then you have Caleb Williams at USC, transferring in from Oklahoma. DJ Uiagalelei still has Heisman odds on him. Dylan Gabriel, who's the new Oklahoma quarterback. You just go down the line, Tyler Van Dyke from Miami, Sam Hartman from Wake Forest, and so forth. Guy, though, that I think I'm going to predict is going to be in this Heisman race at some point this season is Malik Cunningham from Louisville.
Ooh, yeah.
And in talking to coaches from the ACC, he's the guy that really scares them in that conference. There's a lot of good quarterbacks. I think 10 of the 14 teams return quarterbacks from last year's starters. But Cunningham is the one that has that ability, and he cut down his interceptions substantially last year in half. Went from 12 in 2020, which wasn't even a full season, to six last year, and he has that potential to maybe not be Lamar Jackson like, but be a guy that we're talking about in the Heisman chase.
Yeah, Malik Cunningham finished seventh in total QBR last season. Kenny Pickett was ninth. Matt Corral was 10th. Devin Leary was 30th. He's very, very exciting to watch. Obviously, he wasn't the problem. Louisville had plenty of other problems last year. Most of them were on defense, but he alone and an extremely experienced offense around him, Like that makes them very dangerous for anybody with any sort of title aspirations, whether it's Clemson or NC State. At the very least, they're going to be a heck of a spoiler because of him. He's impossibly fun to watch.
What other player predictions do we have going into the that we will get? Not holding you to them completely, but that we're willing to make here on August 3rd.
So you guys mentioned those quarterbacks. There's two quarterbacks that I am at least intrigued by, and I don't know what prediction I want to make yet, but Jeff Levy reuniting with Dylan Gabriel at Oklahoma. I feel like there's something there that is getting overlooked. And maybe it's because Oklahoma lost Spencer Rattler and Caleb Williams, and Caleb Williams is the highlight. And, you know, I don't know. It feels like that's getting overlooked. And I think that could result in something special. There's something going on there. You can see it in recruiting. I always tell people, not everybody loves recruiting. I get that. But you can tell the health of a program by what's happening in recruiting. And they're crushing it right now. So he's a guy. And the other guy, Hendon Hooker at Tennessee.
That's who I was going to name.
Right? Is anybody talking about him? Maybe it's just not my Twitter feed or something, but he had a really good season. I don't know if people forget this, but Joe Milton started the season and Hendon Hooker replaced him. I mean, that is someone that I think with Alex Golish at Tennessee, everyone should remember him.
They were really, really good offensively after he took over last year. And I resent Hendon Hooker because he makes me try to build expectations for Tennessee, which is just kind of, you're just running into the brick wall. And I realize that, but he's really, really good. And he's perfect for that offense. They are obviously with the Josh Heupel offense, you are always, your defense is just going to be out there for more drives. That's just the way it is. They didn't have the depth to account for that last year. They really faded down the stretch. Feels like between experience and recruiting, they should have better depth this year defensively. But man, he's with the talent he has, Cedric Tillman at receiver, Jabari Small at running back, that's going to be a top 10 offense and lots of yards, especially against the lesser opponents on the schedule. They know how to run up the score on those.
So you guys are going on and on about the quarterbacks, but I'm going to give you my prediction for the players, which is the Heisman finalist is going to include a non-quarterback. I'm going to go with options: Bijan Robinson, running back at Texas; Jackson Smith-Njigba, wide receiver at Ohio State; Will Anderson Jr., linebacker at Alabama. One of those three guys is going to say, "Move over, QBs. Look at me."
Anderson should have won it last year. If we're actually giving it to the best player in college football, Will Anderson would have gotten it last year as well.
You know what bothers me about that is he did so well last year. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. It is insane to think that both he and his quarterback have to improve upon last year's numbers. Stop it. They were that good. I mean, look, if they, for some ridiculous reason, were to tank or play poorly or whatever, that's a different story. But as long as they are as good as they were last year, you have to keep talking about them. And I just think it's plain stupid to think that Bryce Young couldn't win it again just because he won it last year.
I think the only thing that gets Will Anderson out of being there for at the Heisman presentation is if Dallas Turner plays really, really well and takes some stats away from him, which is a good thing for Alabama, right? Also, real quick, if Tennessee fans can just add to the record that I said something friendly about them, because they definitely add to the record book that I say negative things, I just want it put in the record that I said something nice.
I'm shocked that the Tennessee fan base turned on a member of the media and made you feel like you never say anything nice to them. And do you feel like special by in that sense, Tom? Because I think we've all heard from Vol Nation at one point or another.
Well, I just want to get on the good side. Is there a good side? We don't know.
I'm sure there's goodness in the hearts of all college football fans.
Right.
But predictions are so much fun. We'll keep doing this as we get closer to the season kicking off. But as we get closer to that end point here, we are continuing our ABCs of college football series. And today's episode is brought to you by the letter V. Not a ton of V teams, Bill, but there's some interesting, there's an interesting group of three here. Vanderbilt, Clark Lee, second year. He's already talking about becoming the best program in college football at some point. I hope we're all alive for that to happen. Virginia and Virginia Tech in the ACC, two teams with new head coach Tony Elliott, finally leaving Clemson for a head coaching jobs in Charlottesville, and then Brent Pry from Penn State, a coach that you and I both know pretty well, going to Blacksburg or returning to Blacksburg, where he really did his apprenticeship under Frank Beamer there, trying to revive the Hokie program to get them in this ACC race at some point, because because it's been a little while.
Yeah, it's going to be, he's going to build exactly the kind of program that Virginia Tech fans say they want. I mean, they're going to be physical. It's blue, like all the buzzwords for Virginia Tech football. Brent Pry is going to absolutely deliver that. The question for him, not really this year. They're going to be okay this year. He didn't inherit a ton of weaknesses, but he didn't inherit a ton of strengths either. So they get to a bowl, whatever, that's fine. But down the line, it's going to be, you know, can he build selling physical to offensive recruits and getting the quarterback you need to win big and all those things. That's going to be the trick for him. And I'm really curious if he can do it, because that defense is going to be really good really quickly. And it's going to be high effort and high intensity.
So I will add to the V for Vanderbilt, because I was at SEC Media Days, and I have to tell you that their quarterback, Mike Wright, came through the room, and sometimes players and people in general light up a room. And he was one of those people. And he had a pin on his lapel. And I asked him what it was. He said, it's a Hercules beetle. And I was like, what is that? He's like, oh, you haven't heard of spiel? I'll tell you about the Hercules beetle. And he said, it can lift 800 times its body weight. And that's why I'm here, because I'm carrying, representing my whole team here. And he's just smiling and he's going in. And he just had such a personality. And he echoed what his coach said, Clark Lee, and his teammates, in that they feel and they truly believe, and I know you hear this in August all the time, that they could surprise some people. And I know that they got dinged a lot for the headlines, you know, we're going to win and everything, and expectations are so high. But I do believe them and their sincerity that they're making progress. And it's hard to measure at a place like that, because it doesn't always show up in the win column.
And sometimes it takes a little bit longer at a place like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to measure them in today's college football world, where Mel Tucker at Michigan State's turning over the roster in year one, where Vanderbilt's not really doing that. Mm-hmm. So,
and it's just so tough in that league, you know, for them to make progress, because so many other teams, like South Carolina, took a step last year. Kentucky has been a game that, if you're a Vanderbilt fan in the past, you think, okay, we got a shot here. Kentucky's way ahead of Vanderbilt. Like everybody's. So yeah, it's a big gap to close. Just in rounding out the V conversation, though, Tony Elliott to me is fascinating, because here's a guy who accomplished everything you really could as an assistant coach, was the play caller for two national championship teams at Clemson, coached different quarterbacks there, from Deshaun Watson to Trevor Lawrence, and DJ last year. But we're just waiting on him to become a head coach. What kind of head coach is he going to be? You always heard, does he have the personality? Is he outgoing enough to be a head coach? Takes over at Virginia from Bronco Mendenhall, inherits a really good quarterback in Brennan Armstrong. What do we expect from Tony Elliott in Virginia in year one?
I think the biggest question I have for them is, you know, Virginia's offense was really good last year and really fun and really weird. They tried things, you know, they threw stuff at the wall. You know, they have, of course, in Keaton Thompson, a guy who was a quarterback, and he's been kind of quarterback running back. They just listed him as football player on the two deep last year. And a lot of their big plays came from just being willing to try unconventional things. I don't necessarily get the impression that they're going to keep trying those unconventional things this year. And I think you could neuter that offense really fast. And so I hope not. I mean, I hope it was so fun to watch. He's got a lot of his weapons back. Brennan Armstrong does. Offensive line is brand new. Everybody's gone from the offensive line, which seems like it might be a pretty bad thing. But the other part for him is just going to be the defense suddenly kind of lacked talent last year, and he's got a lot of rebuilding to do on that side of the ball. He used the portal a lot for defensive linemen, but yeah, there might be a long way to go unless they're continuing to score 40 points a game.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, and that's kind of a strange school in the sense of how do you build that program, right? Yeah. Because what's the recruiting fertile ground that you can go win? And then, like you mentioned, they added some transfers, but I almost feel like he's got to lean in hard this time around, this next cycle in transfers, because you have to get some excitement and you have to build that foundation in order to attract some of those recruits. Because I think his name and him being able to sell, I was at Clemson, I can, you know, I can do the same things here on offense. It's only going to get him so far.
Right.
He's got to show something. He has to do something different. That, you know, Dabo is not going in the transfer portal. He doesn't have a lot of experience doing that. So
It'll be fascinating to see how he builds going forward. In-person podcasts are fun, guys. Do we have to go home? Can we just keep doing these over and over and over, week to week? Or do we actually have to leave and be back with our families?
Yeah, I think the families will start to complain after a while.
There's enough room in this place we could probably hide out for a couple of weeks. Nobody would find us.
At least until the start of the season.
Right.
But anyway, I wanted to thank Tom, Bill, Heather, everyone for listening. And we'll be back with another podcast next week. We're getting closer, guys. The college football season is just around the corner. This has been the ESPN College Football Podcast.